Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Tony Platt on the show. Tony is the author of 13 books and 150 essays and articles on race, inequality, and social justice in American history. Among them, Beyond These Walls, Rethinking Crime and Punishment in the United States, Bloodlines, Recovering Hitler's Nuremberg Laws from Patton's Trophy to Public Memorial, and The Child Savers, The Invention of Delinquency. His work has been translated into German, Spanish, Italian, and Japanese. In addition to scholarly books and publications, Platt has also written for the LA Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, Truth Dig, History News Network, Z Magazine, Nation, Salon, Monthly Review, and The Guardian. He is now a distinguished affiliated scholar at Berkeley's Center for the Study of Law and Society. Platt has taught at the University of Chicago, the University of California, Berkeley, and California State University, Sacramento, where he's received awards for teaching and scholarship. Today, we are covering Tony's new book, The Scandal of Cal, Land Grabs, White Supremacy, and Miseducation at UC Berkeley. Please enjoy our conversation. Tony, how did growing up in Manchester shape your politics?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So yes, I was in Manchester, Northern England, until I was 17. Then I went away to university in England. And I grew up in a progressive family. My parents, when they were young, had been in the Communist Party and then abandoned it when they became adults later on, but retained a very progressive political worldview. We had Left magazines in the household. We had cultural magazines. We took trips to London to see the latest theater. We went to concerts and so on. So it was a very cosmopolitan, global education from my family that I had. And I went to a high school called in England a grammar school at the time, Manchester Grammar School, that became very well known for producing all kinds of intellectuals and public advocates and politicians and playwrights and so on. I grew up in that atmosphere, and a lot of people came to visit my family from other parts of the world and would talk about what was going on. So I, from a pretty early age, around issues of racism in the United States, I was familiar with, and apartheid in South Africa, and against capital punishment, and generally politically aware from a pretty young age of what was going on in the world.
What about the economic decline? I know that the textile industry dropped off significantly during that period. Are there thoughts you have about what's going on in the United States and the Rust Belt and your experience in maybe a city that's similar or going through similar transitions? A lot of those kind of Midwestern cities that are losing some of their industrial kind of centerpieces to the community.
Yes, my father made his money in the textile industry, and textiles were central to the late 19th and early 20th century Manchester until mid 20th century. And then the shift in production and labor to Asia and to other countries meant the rapid decline of that industry. And that affected the deindustrialization of many places in Northern England, like the Rust Belt here. But Manchester managed to avoid that, like some places in the United States managed to avoid that by reinventing themselves or continue to be an important center of commerce and finance and political, cultural, educational life. It's compared to a lot of other places, it survived that and reimagined itself.
What did you learn, or how did you learn about being an intellectual and an academic from your time at Oxford?
Even though I've just told you that my parents gave me a global cosmopolitan education and introduction to the world, I felt very much ill at ease at Oxford. I went to Oxford when I was 17, and going to places like Oxford and London from the north of England in the 1950s and early 1960s was very much like going to another country. It was just another world. So when people today say to me, oh, you come from England, so the assumption is that England is one thing, but it's multiple places, multiple classes, multiple cultures, multiple languages as well, like the United States. So I felt very alienated in Oxford. I managed to find people that I hung out with in the jazz world, and I was an athlete, so I had all of that. But I didn't feel connected to the place, and I hadn't found really what I wanted to be studying or doing. I studied jurisprudence and law mainly out of a failure to choose something else. But the things that really interested me were history, so that when I finally came to the United States and got into grad school in 1963, I was very much attracted from an early age, from early studies, to always doing historical work of one kind or another.
Did you see the film Saltburn?
No, I didn't see that.
Okay. It's maybe a film you should or shouldn't watch, but it's about a kid from Northern England in kind of a Oxford environment. Anyway, let's talk about Berkeley. You were there during all the major events that we continue to talk about today. What do you think you understand about the free speech movement that those who weren't there don't understand?
What I understand about that movement depends on which era you're asking me that question. So I have very different views about it today than I did then. But coming from England and then coming from Oxford, that was run in an extraordinarily conservative way with a hierarchy that you had to respect and observe. And I had a tutor full time who was from the right wing of political thought about the law and the legal institutions. So coming to Berkeley in 63 was not just eye-opening, but it felt like a very comfortable place to be. Like it, my politics and my cultural interests and my intellectual interests combined. And so to come to a place that was in the late 63 and then 64 was filled with the free speech movement and political activism. And then from that period, I went away for a postdoc after I got my did my doctorate and came back. But that whole 10, 15-year period, it was a very lively, politically active campus. And I would say the free speech movement at the time, I thought about it somewhat narrowly. I thought about it as a movement that was about trying to get the university to drop its rules and regulations against freedom of political speech on the campus, which is fairly extraordinary that universities would stop that and that other places around the country also had the same kind of bans on political speech. You think a university would welcome that and would encourage it. So I saw that movement as not so much being it was a radical movement in terms of shaking up universities, but it wasn't didn't have a radical political agenda. It had a very progressive, social democratic, liberal agenda of people being able to say and think what they wanted to think in the space called the university. But what it also showed me is that students can be mobilized and organized in their own interests. They can be active participants in the university and in university life. That was totally new to me and extraordinarily exciting. I think now, having written about that and studied it and thought more deeply about it, I understand that the free speech movement had a much longer history than the 1960s in California, that I found examples of free speech struggles taking place on the Berkeley campus in the late 19th century and throughout most of the 20th century, same kind of struggles. And the second thing that I think I understand more deeply now is that the free speech movement and the civil rights movement were very intertwined, because the university in 1963, for example, was not just stopping any kind of free speech, it was particularly stopping the free speech of student activists who'd gone down to the South for the voter rights struggles that took place in the South and then brought that politics back to to Northern and Western universities. And it was also about a battle within Berkeley that I now understand more deeply, which was about residential segregation in Berkeley itself. A recent book that came out on the history of racial segregation in Berkeley said that this happened in a more organized way in Berkeley than it did in the South. Which was an interesting revelation to me. So that when you look at maps of Berkeley in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, that early on Chinese immigrants and Chinese residents and then a sizable black community were limited about where they could live and where they could be. And that the university encouraged this and participated in it by supporting the real estate organizations that were institutionalized racial discrimination. And in fact, then gave an honorary doctorate to one of the people that was deeply involved in that later on in the 1950s, gave that doctorate to one of the organizers of racial segregation. So for me now, when I think about the free speech movement, I think about the content of that speech and the political battles that were taking place, not just about airing your views, but were also about policies and politics.
Yeah, we just had a great interview with Andrew Higgins, who just published a book about the California Master Plan and its connection to the free speech movement and how intertwined it was with the civil rights movement. I'm also a San Francisco State alum, so part of this
Oh.
history is deeply connected to me in a lot of ways. I want to ask you, because I just finished Max Boot's new book, his new biography of Ronald Reagan. What was your perception of Ronald Reagan during that period and his role in the suppression of activism in Berkeley?
You have to remember at that time, so 1963, I'm 21 years old. I'd like to think that I had a profound, deep insight into what was going on in California around the world, but I didn't. But the movement was united around Reagan's right-wing politics, and Reagan very astutely took on not just the political issues of the students were raising about the war, about feminism, about ethnic studies, about free speech, about political activism, but also took on the cultural politics of the university and painted a picture of Berkeley sort of being wild abandon and sexual freedom and free drugs and all of that stuff that I clearly missed out on when I was a graduate student.
Too much time in the library, huh?
Or it wasn't happening in the way that he said it was happening, which is what I think now, exaggerating how much radical sexual behavior was going on. In 61, for example, in early 60s, they were still doing stings and entrapments of gay students on the Berkeley campus in the men's toilets, setting up stings, and students were not only disciplined or expelled from the university, but were then criminally tried and humiliated for being caught in that way. But Reagan was very astute at exaggerating that, and also exaggerating, which is a big issue today, which is the sense of students at places like Berkeley being spoiled middle class and upper class students who didn't know what a good education was and were taking advantage of the university and didn't study enough and so on. It was a view of dissipated middle class, disaffected youth, alienated youth, not making the most of the privileges that the university offered them. So that was very astute in the politics of Reaganism, and the same way that Thatcherism did it in England. And you can see a long thread of continuity from that kind of politics to what's been going on today.
Yeah, that was the big connection point. Is what Booth's trying to show is the clear connection between Reagan and Trump today. And what was really interesting and fascinating for me was to understand from very early days how Reagan's worldview was so affected by the John Birch Society. I was familiar with kind of broad strokes of his career, but I wasn't. I didn't realize how in touch he was with more radical fringe elements of right-wing worldview.
And earlier than that, the research I've started to do more recently as a supplement to the book is that the American Legion played a very critical role on the Berkeley campus of going after progressive and left and pacifist organizations, and worked very closely with university administrations in taking that on. So, yeah, there's a lot of continuities in this. And it also, I think, helps us to understand that what Reagan began and what Trump is now implementing, that these are social movements. They're not just political parties. And they're very effective at using the strategies and the worldview and the organizing tactics of social movements, a lot of which left organizations used to do as well.
Yeah. One more question about your background before we jump into your written work. How do you think that transitioning from the world of Berkeley to the world of Sacramento State changed your perspective on politics and your ideas around education?
Yeah, so I lost my job from Berkeley in the mid 1970s, and then was very fortunate to get a job at Cal State Sacramento. I commuted there for many years, and that was a very important experience for me. Realizing that I'm coming here in the '60s as an immigrant, having read about the United States and California, but not having a deep understanding of how the place worked, and so going to Sacramento, first of all, just made me understand the class differences in the way that higher education operates. I went from Berkeley, where I had a teaching assistants and research assistants and time off to do research and paid research and money to go to conferences and trips, and also being sought after by other universities and by journalists and so on in the way, not because my views at Berkeley were any different than my views were at Sac State, but the status of the university gets you a lot of privileges and attention, and people want to listen to you and people want to interview on their podcasts and so on. I learned a lot about that, about the class differences of higher education. And also, I got to really teach working class students in a way that I didn't do at Berkeley. Berkeley was much more then and now very much a place of middle class students. So that was a very profound and useful education for myself. And I love teaching there. And the university actually welcomed me there in ways that Berkeley administration didn't welcome me after a while. They liked me as long as I was coming from England, coming from Oxford, and behaving myself. At elite universities, once you begin to bite the hand that's pulling you up the ladder, you get in trouble pretty quickly. But at Sac State, the administration actually, for the most part, welcomed me and helped me get resources so I could do some research and continue to do writing. And welcome the work that I was doing around civil rights issues and affirmative action. It was a very good experience, and I'm still involved. I was involved then in a campaign to try to get the university to reckon with its eugenics past, its involvement with a leading figure in eugenics when the university was founded. And that struggle is still going on. I'm still now working with a group at Sac State to take on that issue, which is it's taken a long time for the university to deal with that.
I've enjoyed reading through a lot of your books. As someone that currently works in K-12 public education, the Child Savers book is a complicated book for me in a lot of ways. And I'm curious your perspective on that book now. And if you feel like a lot of the patterns are just being repackaged that began in the progressive era, we have social emotional learning and there's a lot of emphasis on the whole child, which in some ways it's dialectical because you can see benefits, but you can also see the social control element. How do you think about that book now and thinking about what public education looks like for the average student in low-income communities?
When I look back at that book, when I go back and read it, and particularly the second and third editions, it's still actually in print. I feel, oh, okay, I think I did a good job there. I feel that's not a book I'm ashamed of. In fact, when I look back and think about other people beginning to write those kinds of histories, I realize I was part of a larger group of people that were beginning to do that, to question the historical foundations of so-called do-good policies in the United States. And the last edition of that book, I invited four or five young historians to come in and write critiques of the book and talk about their own work and for me to be in conversation with them. So it's continued to have a life. And I think it still resonates, still the way in which so-called liberal reforms have happened in the United States around so-called welfare issues, around crime and punishment, around education, you still get this long history of movements that have a very sharp sting in their tail, that they set out to be do-gooding and talk about improving people's lives. But it's like the Child Savers of the early 20th century. They talked about helping poor kids and trying to keep them out of prison. And then they created all these youth prisons that force kids to leave the city and go into the country and to be in these very coercive military regimes of reformatories and so on. And you see this also around the history of welfare. And public education, of course, a lot has been written about public education's positive aspects, expanding education beyond middle class and very wealthy people. But on the other hand, education has always had a very sharp social control aspect to it. And in this current book, the last book that I've written, I got very interested in reading a lot of textbooks that young people have been exposed to from the beginning of public education in California. And there found that the ideas, the sort of a whole set of poisonous ideas that gave people wrong information about the history of California, that talked about genocide as though it was inevitable and that somehow it was replaced by progress. So I've returned to this issue of education and also understanding the incredible damage that those textbooks have done to generations of students. I still get to meet students in university and the college that come in who believe that the mission system was a benevolent institution, that think that really wasn't genocide, that yes, it was bad, that what happened, that was the price you paid for progress. And then many of these students are angry that they didn't learn an alternative history or a counterfeit history to that, and are very eager to learn it. But now they're 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. So if this has happened to generations of students, you begin to understand how things that are really a fantasy past becomes like the common sense that people think is true.
Yeah, there was a point early in my career, I think my first or second job teaching at a private religious school, and I remember we got a textbook from a publisher in the South, and there was a section, it was an American history textbook. There was a section on the Civil War, and there was a little kind of partition section on a page, talked about Confederate life and society during the Civil War, and it had a section saying that God actually moved people's hearts more in the South than in the North. And so
Oh.
and I
Yeah.
remember the representative from the publisher came to the school because we brought up a number of concerns about that book and defended them for an hour in a staff meeting. And I couldn't, as a recent grad student, history grad student, I couldn't believe what I was hearing, but it's more common
Well,
than you think.
just one example, though, to echo what you've said, that when I went through these old textbooks and not just textbooks, but popular stories and popular books, the popular literature of California in the late 19th and early 20th century was a lot like the internet today. This millions of people read this stuff. And I remember finding in all these books these wonderful pictures of the mission system. The missions were like Napa spas. They had lovely grounds and horticulture and happy workers and so on. And there were places of forced labor, and people were killed there, and families were broken up, and women were raped, and so on. But the images, those images, in some ways, were more powerful than the text, because they, you look at them, and you go, oh, weren't those native indigenous people lucky to be at those places?
Yeah. Another book that I want to talk about for a moment is Bloodlines. I think it's fascinating from many perspectives. Can you share briefly the impetus for writing that book, and how did it change your perception around the purpose of cultural centers and museums and how they should portray the Holocaust?
Oh, I'm really glad you've read that and have asked me about that, because it's a book that's was published by a small publisher and didn't get many readers and so on. But it's a book that was very important in my history and my development. So my wife, Cecilia O'Leary, is a historian, and the two of us got fellowships at the Huntington Library down in Pasadena, which was a very big deal, because it gave us some time off teaching and allowed us to go in there and do research. They have incredible resources. It's a beautiful place to work, even though it reminded me a bit of the worst of my life in Oxford. And it has all these British mannerisms about it. And we went there to study ni late 19th century cultural history of California, looking at the magazines and the journals and the textbooks, some of the work that then have influenced my later work, to see how California got portrayed. What was the image of California?
The
It was
Oberland Monthly and things like that of that genre.
exactly all of that, yes. And then the notions of civilization bringing progress and bringing light to the wilderness, and there was nothing really here before, and people were so backward and stupid that they didn't know what a good thing they had, that whole argument about California's past. And in the course of doing that research, the Huntington Library announced that they had an original copy of the Nuremberg Laws that had been signed by Hitler, and that they'd kept it secret since 1945. General George Patton had come and left it there, then went back to Germany and died. And so they just hung on to it and kept it. It's an extraordinarily important document, because there are very few documents that we have, original documents signed by Hitler, that ties Hitler's policies against Jews and the Holocaust together. So this has got extraordinary historical value as a document. Everybody knows what the Nuremberg Laws of 1935 said. That's not new, but the document itself is extraordinarily valuable. So we just began to ask questions about why the Huntington, how they got this in 45, why they got it, why they kept it, why they didn't do anything about it, and why they're announcing it now. So we abandoned a lot of the research that we were doing on the 19th century and started doing research on the Huntington from the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s. That research then led to my interest for the first time. We're talking now about the end of the 1990s and early 2000s, my first interest in eugenics, trying to understand the history of this science that basically argues that people are born with different biological attributes, and that some people are more successful than others because of their biology. So it has to do with ability and disability, has to do with race and white supremacy, has to do with gender, has to do with sexuality, and so on. And so that book became a bit of a detective story, trying to follow the history, trying to answer those questions about how the Huntington got it, why Patton got his hands on it. And it became a detective story about that history, and then about what those people that were doing that, what that revealed about their ideas about California, and in particular then about places like Caltech and the Huntington Library being hotbeds of eugenic ideas about superiority and inferiority. Caltech has, in recent years, begun to address that history and has begun to remove their honoring of people that were involved in it that I wrote about in that book. The Huntington Library so far has avoided delving into its history and its past.
Yeah. And how did that writing that book change your perception around portrayal of the Holocaust in museums and cultural centers?
I'd always been interested in museums and histories and that kind of history. And Cecilia O'Leary, my wife, is a historian who's works on museums and the history of cultural ideas, and worked at, later went on to work at the Smithsonian's African American Museum. So we both had strong interests in how museums and educational institutions create what most people think is common sense, but actually are these constructed histories. And but that experience at the Huntington deepened my understanding of California, deepened my understanding of eugenics, and deepen my interest in the way in which cultural ideas play such a major part in politics and in everyday life. And that back in 2000, I helped to organize the first conference on eugenics, which took place in Sacramento. And now, hardly a month goes by without a new book coming out on eugenics. It's become a topic that's being looked at, and histories are being written around the world, not just in North America. And there's a lot of interest in that and trying to understand how it got such a deep foothold inside academic and museum institutions.
Yeah, I'm excited as we get, as things start in the academic space and then filter into public history and we get more accessible books and so we can teach in a lot of ways the history of California. Let's
Yes.
talk about one more book. Sorry, we just you have so many books I want to talk about. It's a struggle for me because I feel like I want to get to the Scandal of Cal, but I have lots of questions about your prior books. So you're a criminologist by training, and I've read a number of books recently. I think I read Beyond Jim Crow when it came out. And then there's been a number of great books. I think just a couple of weeks ago, I did an interview with a scholar from USC that's pu publishing a book called The Carceral State, looking at apartheid and the criminal justice system. There's a lot of writing about this. And I recall this one lecture I attended. I think it was an undergraduate, and it was about the Reformation. And I remember raising my hand during the lecture or after the lecture during the Q&A. And I asked something about the Reformation, and the scholar corrected me, and she said, Reformations. And she said, there isn't one Reformation, there's a series of Reformations. And I feel the same way with the criminal justice system. There's a lot of criminal justice systems. And Beyond the Walls is fascinating in some ways. I want to ask you specifically about California. In your research, are there distinctive elements of the California criminal justice system?
It isn't a system. Using the language of systems, criminal justice is it's multiple governing bodies, it's multiple politics. There doesn't become a cultural way of thinking about that in a uniform way until the 60s and afterwards. But even to this day, you go to different states and different parts of the country, you're going to find different things. And even within a so-called system, there's a lot that's irrational and doesn't complement each other, doesn't work as a system. But anyway, I know what you're saying there. California is interested in a couple of ways, but I think we're just beginning to really understand its deep history. We know a lot about the prison system in particular, and later on the police system, police operations. We know a lot from the 1870s and 1880s on. But around the different forms of policing that happened in the 19th century, we're just beginning to unravel that and begin to understand it, and the relationship between militias and sheriffs and policing and so on, and the relationship with Mexico. That scholarship is just underway. But two parts in which I think California is interesting. One is that California between, say, the 1900s was very much like prison systems in many parts of the world. That is, it played a very critically important role in the political economic development of a region or of a state. So the California prison system played a key role in, for example, in the 1860s and 70s in California. San Quentin had the largest factory system in the whole state, running a 24-hour operation to make jute bags, getting jute from India and then transforming the jute into bags that would be then used for wheat and other products that could be grown and transported. Once you had the railroad system and transportation, once you had refrigeration, you didn't need to just focus on things that had problems with being preserved and so on. But that early history, California prisons played a key role in producing electrical energy at Folsom, in building roads and developing infrastructures of cities, of the jute factories at San Quentin. Prison labor played a central role, as it did in many other parts of the world. It wasn't just unique, but if you study that in California and know about it, it tells you a lot about the role that prisons played. But then, really beginning about the early 20th century, and this is true of California, there's so much labor is available globally, and you have the ability to move labor from one part of the world to another, which was much more difficult in the earlier part of the 19th century. And that as you're able to move your labor force all over the place and also move your economic operations to other parts of the world, prison labor becomes less and less economically useful. It's expensive to regulate it, and you have to invest in security systems to look after prison labor and so on. So beginning in the early 20th century, there's a decline of prison labor, and that's why you get a lot of prisoners are then made to do nothing or basically just do busy work or punitive work and so on. So the history of California is very instructive in that way. And the second way in which I think California history is very important is that after World War II, when you get the notion of prisons becoming places where people could be rehabilitated or transformed into a potential labor force, or transformed into citizens that would be obedient and law-abiding and so on, California was in the forefront of that movement. And at that time, California didn't have many old, dilapidated prison systems that they had to get rid of or change. They could build things anew. So a lot of the new prison systems that were built under the guise of so-called rehabilitation and training and transforming prisoners started in California. So to understand the reality of what rehabilitation was, there never really was a serious rehabilitation program. But to understand what that culture of rehabilitation was about and how then people came from other parts of the world to study what happened in California and take it back to their country, that in that sense, California history is very important.
One final question on that book. Well, it's a two-part question. Why do you think reform is so difficult in criminal justice? And what are your thoughts on the prison abolition movement?
You have a couple of days to discuss this.
Yeah, maybe more about the abolition movement. I have some thoughts myself about how complicated that would be, but what are your thoughts?
In that book, Beyond These Walls, I came across a pamphlet that Eugene Debs wrote in the 1920s. Eugene Debs was the important labor leader in the United States and was also the head of the Socialist Party and went to prison and jail several times for his political activities, and did quite a bit of time in one of the major prisons. And when he came out of prison, he then wrote his ideas about what should happen with prisons. And that's the first example I could find of a political activist calling for abolition. One point to make here is that a lot of what we call to be progressive or new or radical or new ideas usually have a long history. And talking about criticisms of my own history, my own practice, to think that somehow you reinvent radical ideas and that this is new. But so there's been a long history of that. And when Eugene Debs wrote about the prison, he said the only way to really reform the prison is to get rid of it because it's based on exploitation and degrading human beings, et cetera, et cetera. And also, he made the point that there, but for the grace of God, go other people. The people that end up in prison, it's largely because of your class and economic background and bad luck and so on, and that crime is being committed by people of all classes, but it's only poor people that go to prison. So he said that the best solution to the prison system would be to abolish it. But in the meantime, he said, I've got some ideas for how we can at least make it a more decent, more human place now, and came up with all these great ideas about how prison system should be run. And one of the reasons I wrote Beyond These Walls, I didn't write a lot about prisons and police for a long time. It was just too depressing. From really the 1970s until the Obama government, it was all about criticism, how awful they were, how degrading they were, how racist they were. It's important to let people know about that. But a lot's been written about that. I just didn't feel like I had anything to add to that. And also, I think when you write about these issues, you have to have some ideas about what you can do that would make things better or different. And I didn't have any ideas. But then when Black Lives Matter starts, which was probably the most significant mass movement in American history around issues of policing and imprisonment, and then the abolitionist movement, the movement to think, imagine what a society would be without prisons and so on. When that movement began, then I got encouraged to write that book. Partly it influences the way I write a lot of things, which is that how movements can be helped by having a deep historical understanding, and in particular to understand how many people have tried to do reforms around the prison system and policing going back to the 19th century, and how they've pretty much all failed. And to try to understand why people, often with good intentions and interesting programs and so on, like bail reform. There are organizations that have worked for bail reform from the 19 since the 1950s. To bail reform is inherently unjust and unfair because it assumes that if you have money, you can get bail and get out while you're waiting trial, which improves your chances of getting a good lawyer and then not going to jail or prison. And if you're poor and arrested and don't have money, you're going to spend an enormous amount of time in jail waiting to go to trial, which then encourages you to plead guilty because you want to get out or get it over with. So there've been organizations working on bail reform since the 1950s, and it's failed. All those movements have failed. So the book was written in part to try to understand the history of these different kinds of reform movements and why they failed, and why prisons and certain kinds of policing is so important to the fabric of the United States. And so there's two different ways of trying to answer that. In terms of the movements, I think the movements haven't been cooperative enough to deal with these issues. That just to take on police violence without understanding the connection between police violence and other kinds of violence and so on weakens the movement. It means that you can't bring in a lot of people to move for a significant change. If you think about movements that have been extraordinarily successful in this country, think about the labor movement of the early 20th century that finally got the right to join unions. Think about the anti-war movement that was finally successful in stopping the war in Vietnam. The civil rights struggle that really took 100 years from the 1860s to the 1960s that finally got rid of legal white supremacy and legal segregation. That these, when you look back at what made those movements successful, not permanently successful, because once you win something, it doesn't mean to say it's going to stay forever. But because they reached a broad movement of people, in the same way that the Trump movement today is not just a political party, but it's also a social movement that has reached millions of people. And in a way, the right has learned from the successes of the left in the past. I think for movements of reform around criminal justice to be successful, it will take that kind of broad movement, similar to the civil rights and anti-war movements. And then on the other side, I think to understand why we have five cops for every social worker in the United States is why so much money and resources goes into policing, jails, prisons, Native American reservations in the past, deportation policies, and so on. All I think of the carceral system as being very broad and not just being the prisons and jails, but being a much larger set of institutions. But one way to think about that is how important that is to try to maintain this system of inequality. And secondly, I think of it being like this is our welfare system. The United States is the most backward welfare system in the Western world. There's no right to unemployment insurance. So there's no right to making a living. There's no right to housing, et cetera, et cetera. And that in a way that the prisons and policing system are the alternative system of welfare that operates in place of a welfare system. So that sounds maybe a little bit simplistic or reductionist, but that's the way I begin to try to think about these issues.
Yeah, I could ask you probably 20 more questions about that subject, but I want to get to the scandal of Cal, which is the purpose of why we're here ultimately, is to talk about this book, which was fascinating in so many ways. I want to ask you a broad conceptual question to start, which is, how do you think about the concept of institutional guilt or collective responsibility?
I don't particularly like the word guilt. The things that I fight for and write about, I don't do it out of guilt. I do it out of a sense of wanting to see a different kind of world, to see different kinds of institutions, that I think I will benefit from a university system that serves the public good rather than the private good, that I feel I have a self-interest in those things, that the world for me and people I know will be a better world. So Guilt is not something that I have guilt about many things in personal life and so on, but I don't find guilt a useful way of thinking about it. So the other term that you use, responsibility and accountability and reckoning, are the terms that I use. That what would it mean for large-scale institutions to have a reckoning for the past, to deeply understand how the past impacts the present, how millions of people have been affected by what it's done in the past, and to go through a reckoning process, which would not be easy to do, but to go through a reckoning process that brings people into the discussion who have been most affected by the behaviors of the past, and then to figure out a different kind of institution. So what would it mean for Berkeley, for example, to be a university that serves the public good, that is a resource for the public welfare, as opposed to a place that benefits individuals that move up the ladder, either as professors or as students. And I think there's a number of models for that around the world. You have the commissions that were set up in South Africa after the defeat of apartheid. You have many places in the world right now trying to deal with legacies of colonialism, museums going through their collections and going through their histories and talking about where they stand and what they've done and how they can come to terms with that. Some universities on the East Coast that benefited from the slave trade and got their start from making money off the slave trade have begun to reckon with that history. So there are plenty of models have been underway. I think now it's going to be hard to sustain that in the current political climate.
Some of the original residents of the East Bay, which we now call Berkeley, were the Ohlone people. There's lots of different subsets of that kind of larger demarcation for a people group. Where were some of the permanent residents of the Ohlone in relation to UC Berkeley? So I know they were near water sources primarily, and then they had some kind of semi-permanent housing as they would migrate around.
Berkeley and the University of California has benefited enormously from lands and the creativity of Ohlone people. I'll just give you a few examples of that. So, the University of California began during the 1860s, during Lincoln's administration, and that's when so-called land grant colleges were created. And the federal government took land that they claimed was abandoned and not being used and was now public land, and took that land and then gave it to state legislatures around the country. The land in California that the University of California got came mostly from the Central Valley, ended up being very profitable agricultural land, gave that land to the state legislatures, and then the state legislatures could use that money as a startup for their universities. So University of California was one of those so-called land grant colleges. And so the money that the university got from those land from the from those land came from tribes that had been displaced, dispossessed, and driven out by genocide that took place between the founding of the state and the 1860s and 1870s. That those lands themselves played a critical role in the startup of the University of California. And originally, the legislature thought of the university being like an agrarian college, agricultural college, to serve the local interests of the state of California. But when that money came in and when powerful people in California got together, they imagined Berkeley one day being like the Athens of the West, that it would be like they had in mind Harvard and Yale and the British Museum and the Smithsonian as their models for what they wanted to become from pretty early on in the 1860s, 1870s. So that money was key. Then, when they chose the land in Berkeley to create the university, they chose land that people had lived on for at least 2,000 years and maybe as much as 5,000 years. So the Berkeley campus itself was a very vital, important occupation, land that was occupied by Ohlone communities. We know exactly where the center of those communities were, we know where people were buried. And we partly know that because when Berkeley was creating the university, they dug up the graves and dug up the artifacts. So this was widely known. This wasn't a secret of any kind, even though you go through the histories of the university and the documents of the university, the way the university talks about itself, it erases that history. So that would be a second example of land. A third example, this would be more in the 20th century, but Berkeley took over land in Richmond, which they still own, that was part of a very thriving Ohlone a community that was right by the water, that was based on primarily on fishing, but also some manufacture, and that probably was there for between 3 and 5,000 years. They took over that land and still own that land today. And then a final example would be that when University of California, with Berkeley playing a leading role, set up the Manhattan Project that produced the atomic bomb in New Mexico. There were several places around the country where the atomic bomb was created, but Berkeley was very involved in the operation in New Mexico at Los Alamos. Berkeley ran the community there where everybody lived. Berkeley participated in the administration of the lab. Berkeley physicists helped to choose the targets for the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and presided over that. Berkeley created a museum that still exists in Los Alamos that tells the history of Los Alamos and the creation of the atomic bomb from the viewpoint of the military. It's a very military-dominated museum. And that the land that they took over in Los Alamos was land that included very important ceremonial and burial grounds of indigenous peoples in New Mexico, who were then not allowed to visit those lands or visit their ancestors' graves. Land and land development figures very prominently in the history of the University of California. And Berkeley was the first campus of the university. And it was the first campus for about 50 years before UCLA really got going. So when you're looking at the University of California, Berkeley, which is the only campus, we now have 10 campuses. But when you look at the history of Berkeley, you're also looking at the history and formation of the state of California. It was the brains trust for California. Stanford didn't get going until about 20 years later. So, in this sense, I don't think you can extricate the indigenous history of the country and of California from the history of the university in the same way that places like Harvard and Yale and Georgetown can't extricate their histories from the history of the slave trade.
Did you see the Oppenheimer film, Christopher Nolan's adaptation?
I did.
Yeah, and it touches on a few things here. Berkeley plays a prominent role as a setting in the film. What were your thoughts about how it portrayed this time period in Berkeley?
There's two scenes in the movie that are shot actually on the Berkeley campus. And the filmmaker, the director of the film, had to submit scripts to the University of California before the university would allow those scenes to be shot there. Not just the scripts for those scenes, but the script of the whole movie. Berkeley, that was deeply involved in in atomic warfare and in the origins of atomic warfare and building the first weapon of mass destruction, probably that concluded in 3 days of the greatest amount of killing of civilians in the history of warfare. That's not an exaggeration. It's the numbers that we know now are varied depending. There's still research going on that, but we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people that were killed or died eventually from their wounds and from radiation. So that movie turns what was an institutional responsibility, to get back to your word, because Berkeley was not just Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer was a very interesting person and quite a character, and a lot's been written about him, and I can see why he was a perfect person to make the centerpiece of the film. But Berkeley was deeply involved with labs, with the physics department, with the chemistry department, with the administration, with the regents. This was an institutional project, not just on the Berkeley campus in beginning in 1942, but then in the Los Alamos lab as well. And the movie then makes this, as Hollywood biopics often do, makes it into the story of an individual great man. So the institutional responsibility is not there. And to this day, you can go on and look at Oppenheimer and Berkeley, and you can find websites that glorify like where he lived and the parties that he had and what he who the social events that he had and his sex life and so on. And nothing, there's one sentence I have in the book. He went through a security committee after the war, and he was asked at one point by the committee, he said, "Do you have any regrets about what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki?" And his answer, which I found very chilling, he said, "I did what I had to do." So that, in a way, is that's not an individual act. That's a collective institutional act. And the university has not come to terms with that. You could walk around the whole campus. You could go to the buildings where Oppenheimer and the team met together to begin the blueprint of the atomic bomb. You could go across the road to the chemistry building where they developed plutonium experiments that they tried on people without their consent. All of that. You can find a plaque to the Japanese faculty and students on campus, but there's not a word about its involvement in World War II and in the atomic bomb. And I know there's huge political and historical differences about the dropping of the bomb in Japan, but that's what a university should be. A university should be a place where you debate that as opposed to just conceal what happened.
Interestingly, I did some reading about Berkeley's anthropology department after reading a biography of Ursula K. Le Guin, whose father was the first anthropology professor. I think he was maybe the first that was awarded a doctorate in anthropology and then was the first professor of anthropology at UC Berkeley.
Not quite,
Oh,
not
okay, I'm
quite.
off. Yeah, please correct me.
He got his PhD on the East Coast working with Boaz, and was
Yeah,
one of a
at
small
Columbia,
group
correct?
at Columbia. Yes, he's amongst the first people to get a PhD in anthropology, and then he came back and worked as an assistant to the another person who was in charge, Putnam, of the department. And then when Putnam left, he became the chair. So he was the chair of the anthropology department from the 1909 until he retired in something.
Okay. Let's talk about anthropology for a moment. And if you could tie it eugenics for us, and then also I'm curious at some of the quotes from your book. How do you think anthropologists conceptualize what they were doing when they were digging up these burial grounds? I know that there was some conflict internally, but how do you think they perceived what they were doing?
In a previous book that you didn't mention, Grave Matters, which started that started my interest in the plundering of grave sites and so on, and Berkeley's role. In that book, I made the argument that the reason why Berkeley and other universities got deeply involved in this came out of a racist kind of science, that they believed that if they studied the remains of human beings, that they could find biological differences between people who were ended up dying or being killed, and people who were successful, and so on. So it was racist because it assumed that there were racial differences that could be found in the cranium or in the brains. The first important Smithsonian eugenicist sent out like a guidebook to people in the latter part of the 19th century, telling people how they could go to graves, and if they could get to people sooner than later, they could then take the whole cranium and take the brain as well, and how to pack it and send it to Washington to be analyzed, and so on. So I used to think that there was a racist science that drove that where people were doing it in the name of science. But since I've changed my mind about that. And I think one of the reasons why Berkeley got involved in this, before there was an anthropology department, Berkeley was being funded by the Hearst family. Phoebe Hearst inherited a huge amount of money from her husband, and she was very involved in anthropology. She was a regent of the university, and she really ran the anthropology department for the first 9 years, not as a faculty member, but as somebody paying for everybody. And before there was an anthropology department then in the 1900s, she funded three major expeditions to Egypt, Mexico, and Peru. And when I read up on that and researched that, it made me realize that what Berkeley was doing there was not so much science, even though they used the rationale of science and so on, because they brought back about 1,000 human remains to Berkeley before we had an anthropology department. But I think if you look at who was doing that they were following the model set by the Smithsonian and Harvard and the British Museum and German universities and German museums and French universities and French museums. The big boys in academia, the top flight universities, were following colonial invasions. The anthropologists would go in afterwards and would dig up graves and would collect artifacts and buy artifacts dirt cheap and steal them and so on and bring them back to for universities and also for museums, because this is the time of the growth of the public museum in the second half of the 19th century. So museums want all this stuff. They want all this loot. They want these human remains and so on. So that, I think, to me, gave me the sense that Berkeley was doing this because they were trying to play catch up with the other leading universities. And they were very proud of this. So when I go through the regents' records and the administration records and their public relations documents that they put out, they talk about all these expeditions and they talk about how many bodies they brought back and how many artifacts they got and how many millions of things they have and so on. So there's a great deal of pride in this, in the same way that today we have a new computer building going up on the Berkeley campus, and high tech and technology is now what leads the Berkeley campus. But in those early decades of the University of California, anthropology was probably the most important part of the university, along with mining operations and sciences related to mining as well. And then, but then when I researched what happened to all this, the ancestral remains and artifacts when they came back, that there was very little science that took place. Less than 1% was there any kind of science going on or education. And so the title of the chapter where I write about this, I call it hoarding, which is more close to what I think took place than science. They were just proud of how many they had, starting off with 1,000, and then they by the late 20th century, they had 10 or 11,000, which when I started researching how they counted human remains, I think it's more like 20 or 30,000, which would rank the largest so-called collection in the United States, and maybe the largest collection if we included Europe as well. The only way to understand that is then, and this is not being kept in any scientific way, it's not being documented. In fact, people have a hard time hearing this, particularly when I speak to audiences that include native peoples, that they bring back the human remains and then they chop them up into different body parts. They put all the leg bones in one box and all the cranium in another box, and then they put the boxes all over campus and in cellars and basements and so on, and don't document what they have. So Berkeley, in a way, was creating these numbers of how many they had. And of course, they wanted to show off how big their collection was, but they really had no idea. So when I started researching this, I figured that probably they had twice as many ancestral remains and artifacts than they said they did. So I came to understand that whole process as being a process of accumulation. And we live in a society that glorifies accumulation. The bigger, the better. Berkeley wanted to have buildings that were from Europe, not from the Americas. Berkeley wanted to follow models set up by European colonial powers. So that led me into broadening what I did in that book. That book started off with trying to understand Berkeley's resistance to repatriating ancestral remains and artifacts, and then to understand more deeply the racial, eugenic, political, cultural, land, economic history of the university that would help to explain why there's been so much resistance to coming to terms with this past.
A really fascinating documentary that I watched last year. I'm not sure if you saw it. It was called Dahomey, and it's about France repatriating artifacts to Benin in the continent of Africa. And what I loved about it is beside the opening sequence, which you see them essentially packing up the artifacts in Paris, I believe, and then moving them onto pallets and onto ships to go back to their homeland, is that most of the film is really young. I don't know what the plural is, Bunese people reflecting on what this means and how to think about these artifacts and what role they should play. And it was a fascinating film because typically these conversations are just more focused on the people that now hold the artifacts and wrestling with what they should do and less about the people on the receiving end. And so, did you happen to see that documentary?
No, I know the subject matter, but I didn't see that documentary. But I think the care that some museums and some countries and some institutions put into not just repatriating, but how you do it, I think is an important lesson for California, that you have to pay as much attention to that. And when I've gone around and talked particularly to tribal groups about the research that I did for Grave Matters and then for this book, that elders, people start crying. This is to talk about genocide following by criminalization, followed by having your ancestors dug up. What a horror show. What a horrendous way to talk about what you've done, and then claiming that's civilization. We're bringing civilization, we're bringing light to the wilderness, and so on. So there has to be an enormous care into the whole process. And Berkeley's been very reluctant to come clean about the fact that it doesn't have very many whole skeletons left. And it doesn't really know what it has, and it doesn't have good ways of documenting what they have. They've not come clean about that. They want it now. They're moving to try to repatriate and trying to speed that up. But it's not something you can speed up. There's got to be a long process of reconciliation and reckoning that goes on in that and talk. And also, the university has to come to terms with how and why it did that. It's not just something from the past, it's very much a part of the present.
One of the moves that's been often made and is made at a lot of elite campuses like UC Berkeley is to rename buildings. How do you respond to people that say that's just a superficial fix to a broader institutional problem?
You notice that stopped recently. I don't think we've had a renaming in 2 or 3 years. There've been like five, maybe six buildings have been renamed. And let me talk about that first, and then And then I'll come to the second part of your question. But the problem is that the burden for having somebody's name removed and replaced, there's not been any real replacements yet, has to come from the people that work in that department or in that institution. And that's a big deal because you have to do research on it, you have to educate the people in your department, you have to hold hearings to educate people about why you want to do something. You have to invite public response and debate because it's a public, supposedly a public university. So that's a lot of resources and a lot of time. And the university does not provide resources to do that. It's up to an individual department or a library to do that. And also, they don't allow that committee that's been set up to take any initiative around that. So that committee cannot say, we're looking at these five buildings, but I think the most important buildings on campus are the ones that are linked to the Hearst family. George Hearst, it's a fabulous building, the mining building, but George Hearst supported the expulsion of all the Chinese. He voted against the Emancipation Proclamation. He supported the Confederacy during the Civil War. And yet there's been no move to deal with that for reasons I can understand the university not wanting to dig up that part of its past. But this committee is not allowed to look at the interrelationship because all these places are interrelated. And in the book, I try to show how and why they're interrelated. So that's one issue. And in terms of people who say the renaming, we don't need, it's just part of a woke culture and it's, they were people of their times and why should we do that? I think it's important for a number of reasons, not just getting the name off and putting a new name on, but all the historical education that goes on when you go through that process, if it's done right. And I've been involved in a school in Sacramento, a county park in Sacramento, public schools in Palo Alto, and then buildings on the Berkeley campus. And the ones that I think work the best is when there are public conversations and debates, both about who this person was and what they did, and then a debate about what does it mean to take down a name or to get rid of a name and so on. And I always make an argument that in some way a name should not be disappeared. Because once you get a few years beyond the unnaming, then people forget what that history was. So we only have one example on campus, which is a very good one. It's in the law school. If you go into the law school, there's a whole wall. It's an important wall. It's not just off in a side room or something. Everybody sees it. And it explains why this movement occurred to get rid of the name Bolt, after whom the law school was named, and explains who the group of people are with that started that. And what was the process that the law school went through, and then why the law school decided to change the name, and so on. So that people coming there that weren't, didn't know that history and didn't know a part of that history get re-educated. So for me as an educator, that's a key part of it. And I think also there's a lot more buildings being, names being removed and statues being taken down. But the other part of that, I think, is given less emphasis, which is renaming, which I think is very important. So the school I was involved in, Sacramento, had a whole debate amongst the students and the families and the staff about how to get rid of the name of a deeply conservative right-wing eugenicist that thought the Nazis were great. And I worked with them by providing the research on this person. And then they went through a whole debate and ended up deciding to rename the school after Rosa Parks. And so that was a long process. It maybe took a year of education about why the name should be changed and then about who the person was that they wanted to rename it. And the students and the staff and the faculty learned an incredible amount of California history. I think it's a good thing to do. I think the university tends to do it in a way that's too superficial and not systemic, in the same way that we now have land acknowledgements that have become pro forma. I think it's better to have a land acknowledgement than not. But a land acknowledgement is not a reckoning with the past. It's still not required for professors at the beginning of classes to read a land acknowledgement. It's not required at university events. It's still not university-wide.
Last question about the scandal of Cal, and this is a broad kind of implication question. How do you think institutions like Berkeley should approach, and emphasis on the how, writing their institutional histories? How would you, if you were brought in as a consultant for an unnamed public university somewhere that was thinking about writing an institutional history that respect and reckoned with their past, how would you suggest they approach that task?
First of all, I think an institution like the, because Berkeley is so interrelated with the University of California and the Regents. That's a whole other story, but the Regents and the University of California has an independent status in the California Constitution that's extraordinary. It operates a lot more like a corporation and a public university. It's a whole separate issue to explore, but it'd be good if you could maybe one day have a whole discussion about that, because I think it's very important. But I would like to see the Regents, that is the governing body, the University of California President's Office, which is the leading administrative office, and the leading administrators at Berkeley say, we need to take responsibility for what happened, and we need to have a reckoning. We need to have a process of coming to terms with this. It's not just a question of having a little policy over here or there, or saying we're sorry and moving on, but to trying to deeply understand what the university's role was in that history and in that past, and how it still deeply affects people today. So that would be the first part. And then secondly, in terms of University of California and California's specific history, I think relations with indigenous people, that's our slave trade. That's California's history. And it always gets minimized, not to take away from the history of racism against African American, against Chinese, against Mexican Americans, and so on. But there's a way in which the native and indigenous history of this land and this place gets put aside or gets separated from other, quote, more important racial issues and racial histories. And here, I don't think you can understand the history of California or the history of the university without indigenous tribes and people being at the table for any reckoning. So in that process, you would have to have you would have to bring people in the same way that universities on the East Coast dealing with the legacies of the slave trade are bringing in African American organizations to talk about what to do and how to do it, and have been part of the process for the last 10 years. So that would be the second thing. And then thirdly, I'd like to see that also lead to discussions about what's a university for. I've been really struck in this last period of time around the debates about Israel and Gaza and Palestine and the crackdown that are going on in universities, how Berkeley as an institution and the University of California as an institution has not sponsored any educational debates or public events about one of the gravest crises in the history of the last, since World War II, I would say, both at the world level and national level, and risk of nuclear war, genocide in Gaza, debates about the state of Israel, and so on. What struck me is how the university is an institution which you think has all these extraordinary experts on the campus, a lot of whom disagree with each other about what's going on, but has not created an atmosphere of education and public debate about this. So that makes me think then, if the university is not about creating public debate and educating the larger public and itself about the burning issues of the day, then what's it about? And universities like Berkeley are very much plugged into national research programs, still into the military, still into nuclear research, still into tying its development to technology and to high tech these days, and so on. And during COVID, the university didn't stop to say, like, how can we be a resource for people in California during the COVID crisis? Or what would a public university do in this situation? What are our public responsibilities? Yes, we have responsibilities to students that want to get an education and move up the ladder. I understand why people do that. I did that myself. But what does it mean to think about the university as a collective public resource, and particularly in times of crisis, which we're constantly in times of crisis now? So my worry is that we've had almost none of that since the free speech movement on the Berkeley campus. And now, with likely political and federal crackdowns on universities coming happen even more with the Trump administration, universities are going to become more conservative, more contained, more scared of having public debate about hard issues. So those are big things to think about. I was inspired by Eugene Debs in the 1920s and say, yes, we should do all these reforms, but what would it mean to live in a society without prisons? And in the same way, I think today we need that conversation about what would it mean to imagine the university as being a different kind of institution than what it is.
We close these podcasts in the same place, which is book recommendations. These can be books that are important to you, or books that are related to some of the subjects we discussed, or books broadly about California history. What would you recommend to listeners?
Ruth Gilmore's book on the history of prisons in California. If you've never had her on your podcast, and
I have not.
I think wrote one of the most important books. It's been a while since it's been out, but raising the whole question about the economic politics of prisons is very important. There's a new book out. I'm sorry, I don't know the name of the author, but I'm planning on reading it. It's about the tech industry and eugenics. It has eugenics in the title. Just came out a few weeks ago, that I think would be worth reading. There's a lot of important California history. I think one of the most profound writers about California here is Mike Davis, who died last year. Everybody should be reading The Ecology of Fear right now, which is a critique of the environmental policies in California, and particularly in Southern California. That should be must reading now. And I think these days, I wish Mike Davis was here. I'd ask him what he thinks is going on now politically. He did write about the elections and about Trump just before he died. There's extraordinary creative writings that are going on. In some ways, the creative and fictional writing and poetry is much more speaking to the times than histories. But I'll think about it and I can send you some more, but that's where I would start. I just reread, Dorothy Allison just died not too long ago. I just reread Bastet of Carolina, and it's still a brilliant book. And the new edition of the other book that came out in a new edition a few years ago has a really interesting epilogue about her that she wrote about going around talking about that book. Not specifically about California, but there's a lot in California that could learn from that history.
I've actually recently been rereading some Cary McWilliams. I hadn't read him in a long time. And being located in the Central Valley, I think about agricultural labor. And recently, we're recording this on January 14th, there was a Border Patrol raid in Kern County in South Valley. And I've just been thinking a lot about agricultural labor and what it looks like going forward with a lot of threats on the horizon.
Cary McWilliams had real disdain for academic California academic historians. He was a, I think he wrote some incredible histories, but also academia wanted to have nothing to do with him. And when I think about that early literature on California history, there are very few people that did what he did. He wrote several books that are all worth rereading these days. He was also a good historian. He went into documents and so on, as compared with the Bancroft, after whom the Bancroft Library is named on the Berkeley campus, whose history was so shoddy and racist in many places. There's a debate going on today on the Berkeley campus about renaming the
Yeah, I
Bancroft
actually did
Library.
a podcast about how a lot of his writing was actually done by his wife, who was uncredited in the publications. And yeah, that history is fascinating. Can you recommend some fiction? You mentioned fiction, and you piqued my interest as a librarian. So, do you have any fiction recommendations?
I hate to say this, but I read so little fiction. My wife reads fiction every day.
Yeah.
So I'd have to ask her for her
Okay. All
recommendations.
right. Tony,
Yeah.
this has been a lot of fun. I'm sure we could talk for another hour and a half if we could, but our time is up. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and all the books you've published. It's been a joy to really read through your work and see the world through your eyes and understand better the history of California. So thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you for. I get interviewed a lot by journalists and podcasts and people doing things, and usually they want the good quotes, the short explanation or something. So this is the first time I've done an interview with somebody. I wrote recently about my own intellectual history from writing that first book, The Child Savers, to the present. But this is the first time I've ever been interviewed by somebody that's wanted to see the links between different things that I've written and also have read them as well. So I really appreciate you, and I wish more academics would do what you just did in this interview. And your questions were great, and I appreciated the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.